for Pauline Hawthorne. This did not satisfy Izzy, who felt this was an improbable coincidence. At last she turned to the only source she could think of, her mother. Her mother was a journalist, at least in name. True, her mother mostly covered small stories, but journalists found things out. They had connections, they had ways of researching that weren't accessible to just anyone. From early childhood, Izzy had been fiercely, stubbornly independent. She refused to ask for help with anything. Only the deep hunger to unravel this mysterious photograph could have convinced her to approach her mother. "Mom," she said one evening, after several days of fruitless research, "can you help me with something?" Mrs. Richardson listened, as usual with Izzy, with only half her attention. A pressing deadline was looming for a story on the Nature Center's annual plant sale. "Izzy, this photo probably isn't even of Pearl's mother. It could be anyone, someone who looks like her. I'm sure it's just a coincidence." "It's not," Izzy insisted. "Pearl knew it was her mother, and I saw it, too." "But would you just look into it? Call the museum or something, see what you can find out. Please?" She had never been good at wheedling. She'd always felt flattery was a form of lying, but she wanted this so badly. "I'm sure you can figure it out. You're a reporter." Mrs. Richardson gave in. "All right," she said. "I'll see what I can find out, but it'll have to wait until after this deadline. I have to file this story by tomorrow." "It'll probably be nothing, you know," she added, as Izzy danced toward the door with barely suppressed glee. Izzy's words, "You're a reporter," had touched her mother's pride like a finger pressed into an old bruise. Mrs. Richardson had wanted to be a journalist her entire life, long before the aptitude tests their guidance counselor had administered in high school. "Journalists," she explained in a civic speech about dream careers, "chronicle our everyday lives. They reveal truths and information that the public deserves to know, and they provide a record for posterity, so that future generations can learn from our mistakes and improve upon our achievements." For as long as she could remember, her own mother had always been busy with some committee or other, advocating for more school funding, more equity, more fairness, and bringing her young daughter along. "Change doesn't just happen," her mother had always said, echoing the Shaker motto. "It has to be planned." In history class, when young Elena had learned the term noblesse oblige, she'd understood it at once. Journalism, to Mrs. Richardson, seemed such a noble calling, one where you could do good from within the system. And in her mind, she envisioned a mix of Nellie Bly and Lois Lane. After working on the school paper for 4 years and working her way up to co-editor-in-chief by senior year, this seemed not only possible, but inevitable. She graduated second in her class and had had her choice of colleges, a full ride at Oberlin, a partial scholarship at Denison, acceptances all over the state from Kenyon to Kent State to Worcester. Her mother had been in favor of Oberlin, had urged her to apply in the first place, but when Elena visited the campus, she felt immediately out of place. The co-ed dorms unsettled her, all the men in their skivvies, the girls in their robes, the knowledge that at any moment a boy might saunter into her room, or worse, the bathroom. On the steps of one building, three long-haired students in dashikis sat playing slide whistles. Across the green, students held up posters in silent protest. "Drop acid, not bombs. I don't give a damn about the president. Bombing for peace is like fucking for virginity." It felt, to Elena, like a foreign country where rules did not reach. She fought the urge to fidget as if the campus were an itchy sweater. So she'd headed to Denison the following fall instead, with an ambitious and illustrious future plotted out for herself. On the second day of classes, she met Billy Richardson, tall and handsome in the Clark Kent vein, and by the end of the month they were going steady. Chastely, they made plans for the future. After graduation, a white wedding in Cleveland, a house in Shaker, lots of children. Law school for him, a cub reportership for her. A plan they followed meticulously. Soon after they married and settled into a rented duplex in Shaker, Mr. Richardson started law school and Mrs. Richardson was offered a position as a junior reporter at the Sun Press. It was a small paper, focused on local news, and the pay was commensurately low. Still, she decided, it was a promising enough place to start. In time, perhaps, she'd be able to make the jump over to the Plain Dealer, Cleveland's real newspaper. Though, of course, she'd never want to leave Shaker. Could not imagine raising a family anywhere else. She dutifully covered all the local news conferences, city politics, the regional effects of new regulations on everything from bridges to tree planting, sharing responsibilities with the other junior reporter, Dwight, who was a year younger. It was a good workplace, allowing her to take 6 weeks of maternity leave after Lexi's birth, then trips, then Moody's. By the time Izzy came around, however, Mrs. Richardson found herself still at the Sun Press. Senior reporter now, but still relegated to covering the small stories, the small news. Dwight, meanwhile, had moved to Chicago to take a job at the Tribune. Was it because of the time she'd taken off? Or the fact, as she was starting to realize, that she had no desire to tunnel into hard stories and bitter tragedies? She would never be quite certain, but the more time passed, the less probable it seemed that she could move elsewhere, and it became a question of chickens and eggs. No one at the Plain Dealer, or anywhere else for that matter, seemed to be interested in taking on a reporter nearing 40, with 4 children and all the attendant obligations, who had never covered a big story, and it didn't matter whether that was the chicken or the egg. And so she stayed. She focused on the feel-good stories, the complimentary write-ups of progress, the new recycling initiative, the remodeling of the library, the ribbon-cutting ceremony at the new playground behind it. She covered the swearing-in of the new city manager, solemn, and the Halloween parade, spirited. The opening of Half Price Books at Van Aken Center, a much-needed addition to Shaker's commercial district. The debate on spraying for gypsy moths, heated on both sides. She reviewed the production of Grease at the Unitarian Church and Guys and Dolls at the high school. Rollicking, she wrote of one. Sit down, they're rocking the boat, she wrote of the other. She became known as reliable, and for turning in clean copy, if, though no one said it out loud, routine and rather pedestrian and terribly nice. Shaker Heights was dependably safe, and thus the news, such as it was correspondingly dull. Outside in the world, volcanoes erupted, governments rose and collapsed and bartered for hostages, rockets exploded, walls fell. But in Shaker Heights, things were peaceful, and riots and bombs and earthquakes were quiet thumps, muffled by distance. Her house was large, her children safe and happy and well-educated. This was, she told herself, the broad strokes of what she had planned out all those years ago. Izzy's request, however, brought something new. Something intriguing, or at very least, interesting. Something perhaps worth investigating at last. True to her word, Mrs. Richardson filed her story and turned to the mysterious photograph. On a lunch break the next day, she stopped by the museum to see it for herself. Until then, she'd been sure Izzy was just imagining things, but she had been right. It was definitely Mia, in a Pauline Hawthorne photograph. She had heard of Pauline Hawthorne, of course. What was the story here? Mrs. Richardson puzzled over this as she dropped the folded 5 into the museum's donation box and headed out to her car, genuinely intrigued. Her first step was to call the art gallery that had lent the photograph to the exhibit. Yes, the owner told her. They'd purchased the photograph in 1982 from a dealer in New York. It had been shortly after Pauline's death, and there had been much excitement in the art world when this previously unknown photograph had been put up for sale. There had been a fierce auction, and they'd been thrilled to walk away with it for $50,000. Really a bargain. Yes, the photograph had been conclusively attributed to Pauline Hawthorne. The dealer had sold many of Pauline's works over the years, and the photograph, the only print, they'd been told, had been signed by Pauline herself on the back. No, the owner of the photograph had been anonymous, but they'd be happy to give Mrs. Richardson the name of the art dealer. Mrs. Richardson took it down, and Anita Rees, and after a quick call to New York City's public information, obtained the phone number of the Rees Gallery in Manhattan. Anita Rees, when reached on the telephone, proved to be a true New Yorker, brisk, fast-talking, and unflappable. A Pauline Hawthorne? Yes, I'm sure I did. I represented Pauline Hawthorne for years. Through the phone, Mrs. Richardson heard the faint blare of a siren passing by and then receding into the distance. In her mind, that was always what New York sounded like. Honking, trucks, sirens. She had been to New York only once, in college, in the days when you had to hold your purse tight with both hands and didn't dare touch anything on the subway, even the poles. It had been cemented in her memory that way. But this photo, Mrs. Richardson said, was sold after Pauline's death, by someone else. It was a photo of a woman holding a baby, Virgin and Child Number One, it was called. The phone line suddenly went so quiet that Mrs. Richardson thought they'd been disconnected. But after a moment, Anita Rees spoke again. "Yes, I remember that one." "I'm just wondering," said Mrs. Richardson, "if you could give me the name of the person who sold the photograph." Something new flared in Anita's voice. Suspicion. "Where did you say you were calling from again?" "My name is Eleanor Richardson." Mrs. Richardson hesitated for a moment. "I work as a reporter for the Sun Press in Cleveland, Ohio. It's related to a story I'm researching." "I see." Another pause. "I'm sorry, but the original owner of that photograph wished to remain anonymous. For personal reasons. I'm not at liberty to give the seller's name." Mrs. Richardson crimped the corner of her notepad in annoyance. "I understand. Well, what I'm actually interested in is the subject of the photograph. Would you happen to have any information on who she is?" This time there was no mistaking it. Definite, wary silence. And when Anita Rees spoke again, it was with a touch of frost. "I'm afraid I don't have anything I can share about that. Good luck with your story." The line went dead with a soft click. Mrs. Richardson set the phone down. As a journalist, she was no stranger to being hung up on, but this time irritated her more than most. Maybe there was something here, some strange mystery waiting to be unraveled. She glanced at her monitor, where a half-drafted piece, "Should Gore Run for President? Locals Weigh In," sat waiting. Art collectors were often reclusive, she thought, especially where money was involved. This Anita Rees might not even know anything about the photo, other than whatever her commission was. And who had started her down this garden path anyway? Izzy, her harebrained live wire of a daughter, the perpetual overreactor, prone to fits of furious indignation about nothing at all. That alone, she thought, was a sign she was headed down a rabbit hole. She turned her notebook back to the page on the vice president, and began to type. 9. Mrs. Richardson remained annoyed with Izzy all week, though, truth be told, she was usually annoyed with Izzy for some reason or another. The roots of her irritation were long and many-branched and deep. It was not, as Izzy herself suspected, and as Lexi in moments of meanness teased her, because she had been an accident or unwanted. In fact, it was quite the opposite. Mrs. Richardson had always wanted a large family. Having been an only child herself, she had grown up longing for brothers and sisters, envying her friends like Maureen O'Shaughnessy, who never came home to an empty house, and who always seemed to have someone to talk to. "It's not so great," Maureen assured her, especially if you get brothers. Maureen was the oldest of 15, and her sister Katie was the youngest of 2, and in between came 6 boys. But Mrs. Richardson was convinced that even 6 brothers would be better than growing up alone. "Lots of kids," she had said to Mr. Richardson when they'd gotten married. "At least 3 or 4, and close together," she'd added, thinking of the O'Shaughnessys again. How it was an off year that they didn't have an O'Shaughnessy in the grade. Everyone knew them. They were a dynasty in Shaker Heights, a huge and boisterous and exceedingly handsome clan that always seemed to be suntanned and windswept, like the Kennedys. Mr. Richardson, who had 2 brothers himself, agreed. So they'd had Lexi first, in 1980, then Tripp the next year, and Moody the year after that. And Mrs. Richardson had secretly been proud of how fertile her body had proved, how resilient. She would push Moody in his stroller, with Lexi and Tripp tagging along behind her, each clutching a handful of her skirt like baby elephants trailing their mother. And people on the street did a double take. This slender young woman couldn't possibly have borne 3 children, could she? "Just 1 more," she'd said to her husband. They had agreed to have the children early so that afterward Mrs. Richardson could go back to work. A part of her wanted to stay home, to simply be with her children, but her own mother had always scorned those women who didn't work. "Wasting their potential," she had sniffed. "You've got a good brain, Elena. You're not just going to sit home and knit, are you?" A modern woman, she always implied, was capable, nay, required, to have it all. So after each birth, Mrs. Richardson had returned to her job, crafted the pleasant, wholesome stories her editor demanded, come home to fawn over her little ones, waited for the next baby to arrive. It wasn't until Izzy that the charmed row of children came to an end. For starters, Mrs. Richardson had had terrible morning sickness, bouts of dizziness and vomiting that didn't end with the first trimester but continued on unabated, if anything, more vigorously as the weeks went on. Lexi was nearly 3, Tripp 2, Moody just 1, and with 3 very young children at home and Mrs. Richardson incapacitated, the Richardsons found it necessary to engage a housekeeper, a luxury they would become accustomed to, and which they would continue all the way into the children's teenage years, all the way up to Mia. "It's a sign of a strong pregnancy," the doctors assured Mrs. Richardson. But a few weeks after hiring the housekeeper, she had begun to bleed and was placed on bed rest. Despite these precautions, Izzy had arrived precipitously soon thereafter, making her appearance, 11 weeks early, an hour after her mother arrived at the hospital. Mrs. Richardson would remember the next few months only as a vague, terrifying haze. Of the logistical details, she remembered only a little. She remembered Izzy curled in a glass box, a net of purple veins under salmon-colored skin. She remembered watching her youngest through the portholes in the incubator, nearly pressing her nose to the glass to be sure Izzy was still breathing. She remembered shuttling back and forth between home and the hospital whenever she could leave her oldest 3 in the capable hands of the housekeeper, nap time, lunch time, an hour here and there, and when the nurses allowed it, cradling Izzy against her. First in her 2 cupped hands, then in the hollow between her breasts, and finally, as Izzy grew stronger and filled out and began to look more like a baby, in her arms. For Izzy did grow. Despite her early start, she displayed a tenacity of will that even the doctors remarked upon. She tugged at her IV. She uprooted her feeding tube. When the nurses came to change her, she kicked her thumb-sized feet and hollered so loudly the babies in nearby incubators woke and joined in. "Nothing wrong with her lungs," the doctors told the Richardsons, though they warned of a host of other problems that might arise. Jaundice, anemia, vision issues, hearing loss, mental retardation, heart defects, seizures, cerebral palsy. When Izzy finally came home, 2 weeks after her scheduled due date, this list would be one of the few things Mrs. Richardson would recall about her time in the hospital. A list of things she would scan Izzy for over the next decade. Did Izzy simply not notice things, or was she going blind? Was she ignoring her mother out of stubbornness, or was she going deaf? Was her skin looking a bit yellow? Was she looking a bit pale? If Izzy's hand, reaching to add a stacking ring to her toy, fumbled, Mrs. Richardson found herself clutching the arms of her chair. Was it a tremor or just a child learning the complicated business of managing her own fingers? Everything Mrs. Richardson had put out of her mind from the hospital stay, everything she thought she'd forgotten, her body remembered on a cellular level. The rush of anxiety, the fear that permeated her thoughts of Izzy, the microscopic focus on each thing Izzy did, turning it this way and that, scrutinizing it for signs of weakness or disaster. Was she just a poor speller, or was this a sign of mental impairment? Was her handwriting just messy? Was she just bad at arithmetic? Were her temper tantrums normal, or was it something worse? As time went on, the concern unhooked itself from the fear and took on a life of its own. She had learned, with Izzy's birth, how your life could trundle along on its safe little track, and then, with no warning, skid spectacularly off course. Every time Mrs. Richardson looked at Izzy, that feeling of things spiraling out of control coiled around her again, like a muscle she didn't know how to unclench. "Izzy, sit up straight," she would say at the dinner table, thinking, "Scoliosis, cerebral palsy." "Izzy, calm down." Though she would never quite articulate it this way, resentment began to sheathe concern. "Anger is fear's bodyguard," a poster in the hospital had read. But Mrs. Richardson had never noticed it. She was too busy thinking, it wasn't supposed to happen this way. "After all the trouble you've caused," she would begin sometimes, when Izzy misbehaved. She never finished the sentence, even in her mind, but the old anxiety snaked through her veins. Izzy herself would remember only her mother saying, "No, no, Izzy, why can't you listen to me? Izzy, behave yourself! Izzy, for God's sakes! No, are you insane?" Drawing the boundaries over which Izzy dared to step. Had Izzy been a different kind of child, this might have led her to be cautious, or neurasthenic, or paranoid. Izzy, however, had been born to push buttons, and as she grew, with excellent vision and hearing, no sign of seizures or palsy, and a clearly agile mind, the more closely her mother watched her and the more she chafed at the attention. When they went to the pool, Lexi and Tripp and Moody were allowed to splash in the shallow end, but Izzy, then age 4, had to sit on a towel, coated in sunscreen and shaded by an umbrella. After a week of this, she jumped headfirst into the deep end and had to be rescued by the lifeguard. The following winter, when they went sledding, Lexi and Tripp and Moody slid shrieking down the hill, backward and belly first and three at a time, and once, in Tripp's case, standing up like a surfer. Mrs. Richardson, perched atop the hill, applauded and cheered. Then Izzy went down once, tipped over halfway down, and Mrs. Richardson refused to let her get into the sled again. That evening, after everyone had gone to bed, Izzy dragged Moody's sled across the street and slid down the bank of the duck pond and out onto the frozen water 4 times before a neighbor noticed and called her parents. At 10, when her mother fretted about her picky eating, wondering if she might be anemic, Izzy declared herself a vegetarian. After being grounded from sleepovers, "If you can't behave at home, Izzy, we can't trust you to behave in someone else's house." Izzy took to sneaking outside at night and returning with pine cones or a handful of crab apples or a buckeye to leave on the kitchen island. "I have no idea where that could have come from," she would say in the morning, as her mother eyed her latest offering. The sense all the children had, including Izzy, was that she was a particular disappointment to their mother. But for reasons unclear to them, their mother resented her. Of course, the more Izzy pushed, the more anger stepped in to shield her mother's old anxiety, like a shell covering a snail. "My God, Izzy," Mrs. Richardson said over and over again, "what is wrong with you?" Mr. Richardson was more tolerant of Izzy. It had been Mrs. Richardson who had held her, Mrs. Richardson who had heard all the doctor's prognosis, the dire warnings about what might be in store for her. Mr. Richardson, newly graduated from law school, was busy building his practice, working long hours in an attempt to make partner. To him, Izzy seemed a trifle willful, but he was glad to see her undaunted after such a terrifying start. He delighted in her intelligence, in her spirit. In fact, she reminded him of her mother when she'd been younger. He'd been drawn to that spark, that certainty of purpose, how she always knew her mind and had a plan, how deeply concerned she was with right versus wrong, the fiery side of her that seemed, after so many safe years in the suburbs, to have cooled down to embers. "It's okay, Elena," he would say to Mrs. Richardson. "She's fine. Let her be." Mrs. Richardson, however, could not let Izzy be, and the feeling coalesced in all of them. Izzy pushing, her mother restraining, and after a time, no one could remember how the dynamic had started, only that it had existed always. The weekend after Thanksgiving, while Mrs. Richardson was still irked at Izzy, the Richardsons were due to attend a birthday party thrown by old family friends. "Can Pearl come too?" Moody asked. "The McCulloughs won't mind. They've invited everyone they know to this thing." "Plus she'll be one more person to gush over the baby," Izzy said, "which you know is the whole point of this entire party." Mrs. Richardson sighed. "Izzy, there are times when it's appropriate to invite one of your friends and times when events are just for family," she said. "This is a family event. Pearl is not part of the family." She snapped her purse shut and slung it over her shoulder. "You need to learn the distinction. Come on, we're late." So only the Richardsons went to the McCulloughs that weekend, arriving in two cars, Lexi and Tripp and Moody in one, Mr. and Mrs. Richardson in another, with a glowering Izzy in the back seat. No one could have missed the house. Vehicles filled both sides of the street. The McCulloughs had cleared the parking restrictions with the Shaker Heights police in advance and spilled over onto the nearby South Woodland Boulevard, and an enormous bundle of pink and white balloons bobbed over the mailbox. Inside, the house was already full to overflowing. There were mimosas and an omelet station. There were caterers offering bite-sized quiches and poached eggs in puddles of velvety hollandaise. There was a three-tiered pink and white cake, draped in fondant and topped with a sugar figurine of a baby holding the number one in its chubby hands. And everywhere, pink and white streamers unfurling their triumphant way toward the kitchen table, where Mirabelle McCullough, the birthday girl, nestled in Mrs. McCullough's arms. Mrs. Richardson had met Mirabelle before, of course, months earlier, when she'd first arrived at the McCullough household. She and Linda McCullough had grown up together, Shaker class of 1971, old friends since meeting in second grade, and there had been a lovely symmetry to their paths as they'd both gone away to school and come back and settled in Shaker into careers of their own. Only where the Richardsons had right away had Lexi, then Tripp, and Moody and Izzy in quick succession, Mrs. McCullough had undergone over a decade of trying before she and her husband had decided on adoption. "It's just providential, as my mother used to say," Mrs. Richardson had told her husband on hearing the news. "There's simply no other word for it. You know what Mark and Linda have been through, all that waiting. I mean, I bet they'd have taken a crack baby, for goodness sakes. And then out of the blue, the social worker calls them at 10:30 in the morning, saying there's been a little Asian baby left at the fire station. And by 4 o'clock in the afternoon, there she is in their house." She had gone over the very next day to meet the baby, and in between cooing over the child, heard Linda recount the story. How she'd gotten the call and had driven directly to Babies R Us, buying everything from a complete wardrobe to a crib to 6 months' supply of diapers. "Maxed out the visa," Linda McCullough had said with a laugh. "Mark was still putting the crib together when the social worker pulled up with her. But look at her. Just look at her. Can you believe this?" She had bent over the infant cradled against her with a look of pure astonishment. That had been 10 months earlier, and the adoption process was well underway now. They hoped to have it finalized in a month or two, Mrs. McCullough told Mrs. Richardson as she handed her a mimosa. Little Mirabelle was a darling thing, a fuzz of dark hair topped by a pink ribbon headband, a round, pert face with two enormous brown eyes staring out at the crowd, Mrs. McCullough's beaded necklace clenched in her fingers. "Oh, she looks like a little doll," gasped Lexi. Mirabelle turned her face away and buried it in Mrs. McCullough's sweater. "This is the first big party we've had since she came to us," Mrs. McCullough said, running a hand over the girl's dark head. "She's not used to having so many people around. Are you, Mimi?" She kissed the baby's palm. "But we couldn't let her first birthday go by without a celebration." "How can you know it's her birthday?" Izzy asked. "If she was abandoned and all." "She wasn't abandoned, Izzy," Mrs. Richardson said. "She was left at a fire station where someone would find her safely. It's a very different thing. It's brought her to this very good home."
"But you don't know her real birthday then, do you?" Izzy said. "Did you just pick some random day?"
Mrs. McCullough adjusted the baby in her arms. "The social workers estimated she was 2 months old when she came to us, give or take a couple of weeks. That was January 30th, so we decided we'd celebrate November 30th as her birthday." She gave Izzy a tight smile. "We think we're very lucky to be able to give her a birthday. It's the same as Winston Churchill's and Mark Twain's."
"Is her name really Mirabelle?" Izzy asked.
Mrs. McCullough stiffened.
"Her full name will be Mirabelle Rose McCullough, once the paperwork goes through," she said. "But she must have had a name before," Izzy said. "Don't you know what it is?"
As a matter of fact, Mrs. McCullough did know. The baby had been tucked in a cardboard box, wearing several sets of clothing and cocooned in blankets against the January cold. There had been a note in the box, too, which Mrs. McCullough had eventually convinced the social worker to let her read. "This baby named Mei Ling. Please take this baby and give her a better life." That first night, when the baby had finally fallen asleep in their laps, Mr. and Mrs. McCullough spent 2 hours flipping through the name dictionary. It had not occurred to them, then or at any point until now, to regret the loss of her old name. "We felt it was more appropriate to give her a new name to celebrate the start of her new life," she said. "Mirabelle means wonderful beauty. Isn't that lovely?"
Indeed, staring down that night at the baby's long lashes, the little rosebud mouth half open in deep and contented slumber, she and her husband had felt nothing could be more appropriate. "When we got our cat from the shelter, we kept her name," said Izzy. She turned to her mother. "Remember? Miss Purdy? Lexi said it was lame, but you said we couldn't change it. It would be too confusing to her."
"Izzy," Mrs. Richardson said, "behave yourself." She turned to Mrs. McCullough. "Mirabelle has grown so much over the past few months. I wouldn't recognize her. So skinny before, now look at her. She's chubby and glowing. Oh, Lexi, look at those little cheeks." "Can I hold her?" Lexi asked. With Mrs. McCullough's help, she settled the baby against her shoulder. "Oh, look at her skin. Just like Café au lait." Mirabelle reached out and laced her fingers into Lexi's long hair, and Izzy drifted sullenly away.
"I do not get the obsession," Moody murmured to Tripp in the corner behind the kitchen island, where they had retreated with paper plates of quiche and pastries. "They eat, they sleep, they poop, they cry. I'd rather have a dog." "The girls love them," said Tripp. "I bet if Pearl were here, she'd be all over that baby."
Moody could not tell whether Tripp was mocking him or simply thinking about Pearl himself. He wasn't sure which possibility bothered him more.
"You were listening in health class when they talked about precautions, right?" he asked. "Otherwise, there are going to be dozens of girls running around with baby Tripps." Horrific thought. "Ha ha," Tripp forked a piece of egg into his mouth. "You just worry about yourself. Oh, wait. In order to knock someone up, someone has to actually sleep with you."
He tossed his empty plate into the garbage can and went off in search of a drink, leaving Moody alone with the last few bites of his quiche, now gone cold. At Lexi's request, Mrs. McCullough took her for a tour of Mirabelle's room.
decorated in pink and pale green with a hand-stitched banner above the crib spelling out her name.
"She loves this rug," Mrs. McCullough said, patting the sheepskin on the floor.
"We put her down after her bath, and she rolls around and just laughs and laughs. Then there was Mirabelle's playroom, a whole enormous bedroom devoted to her toys. Wooden blocks in all colors of the rainbow, a rocking elephant made from velvet, an entire shelf of dolls."
"The room at the front of the house is bigger," explained Mrs. McCullough, "but this room gets the best sun, all morning and most of the afternoon. So we made the other into the guest room and kept this one as a place for Mirabelle to play."
When they returned downstairs, even more guests had arrived, and Lexi reluctantly relinquished Mirabelle to the newcomers. By cake-cutting time, the birthday girl, worn out from all the socializing, had to be whisked away for a bottle and put down for a nap. And to Lexi's great disappointment, she was still asleep at the end of the party when the Richardsons headed home.
"I wanted to hold her again," she complained as they made their way back to their cars.
"She's a baby, not a toy, Lex," Moody put in.
"I'm sure Mrs. McCullough would love it if you'd offer to babysit," Mrs. Richardson said. "Drive carefully, Lexi. We'll see you at home."
She nudged Izzy toward the other car by one shoulder.
"And you need to be less rude next time we go to a party, or you can just stay home. Linda McCullough babysat you when you were little, you know. She changed your diapers and took you to the park. You think about that the next time you see her."
"I will," said Izzy and slammed her car door. Lexi could talk of nothing else but Mirabelle McCullough for the next few days.
"Baby fever," Tripp said and nudged Brian. "Watch out, dude."
Brian laughed uneasily. Tripp was right, though. Lexi was suddenly, furiously interested in all things baby, even going to Dillard's to buy a frilly and thoroughly impractical lavender dress as a present for Mirabelle.
"My God, Lexi, I don't remember you being so excited about babies when Moody and Izzy were little," her mother said. "Or dolls, for that matter. In fact," Mrs. Richardson cast her mind back, "once you actually shut Moody in the pots and pans cupboard."
Lexi rolled her eyes. "I was 3, she said. She was still talking about the baby on Monday, and when Mia arrived in the kitchen that afternoon, Lexi was delighted to have a fresh audience.
"Her hair is so gorgeous," she gushed. "I've never seen so much hair on a little baby. So silky. And she has the biggest eyes. They just take everything in. She's so alert. They found her at a fire station. Can you believe that? Someone literally just left her there."
Across the room, Mia, who had been wiping the countertops, froze.
"A fire station?" she said.
"A fire station where?"
Lexi waved a hand. "I don't know. Somewhere in East Cleveland, I think." The details had been less important to her than the tragic romance of it all.
"And when did this happen?"
"January, something like that. Mrs. McCullough said that one of the firemen came out for a smoke and found her there in a cardboard box."
Lexi shook her head.
"Like she was a puppy someone didn't want."
"And now the McCulloughs plan to keep her?"
"I think so." Lexi opened the cupboard and helped herself to a Nutri-Grain bar. "They wanted a baby forever, and then Mirabelle appeared. Like a miracle. And they've been trying to adopt for so long. They'll be such devoted parents."
She peeled the wrapper from the granola bar and popped it into the garbage can and went upstairs, leaving Mia deep in thought. Mia's arrangement with Mrs. Richardson paid for their rent, but she and Pearl still needed money for groceries and the power bill and gas, so she had kept a few shifts per week at Lucky Palace, which between wages and leftover food was just enough to keep them supplied. Lucky Palace had a cook, a prep cook, a busboy, and one full-time waitress, Bibi, who had started a few months before Mia. Bibi had come over from Canton 2 years earlier, and although her English was rather choppy, she liked to talk with Mia, finding her a sympathetic listener who never corrected her grammar or seemed to have trouble understanding her. While they rolled plastic silverware and napkins for the dinner takeout orders, Bibi had told Mia quite a lot about her life. Mia shared very little in return, but she'd learned over the years that people seldom noticed this if you were a good listener, which meant you kept the other person talking about herself. Over the course of the past 6 months, she'd learned nearly all of Bibi's life story, and it was because of this that Lexi's account of the party had caught her attention. for Bibi, a year earlier, had had a baby.
"I's so scared, Ben,"
she told Mia, fingers working the soft paper of the napkin. "I have nobody to help me. I cannot go to work. I cannot sleep. All day long, I just hold the baby and cry."
"Where was the baby's father?"
Mia had asked. And Bibi had said, "Gone."
"I tell him I having a baby. 2 weeks later, he disappear. Somebody told me he moved back to Guangdong. I move here for him, you know that? Before that, we living in San Francisco. I am work in dentist's office as a receptionist. I get good money, really nice boss. He get a job here in the car plant. He say Cleveland is nice. Cleveland is cheap. San Francisco so expensive. We move to Cleveland. We can buy a house, have a yard. So I follow him here. And then..." She was silent for a moment, then dropped a neat, rolled-up napkin onto the pile, chopsticks, fork, and knife all swaddled together inside. "Here, nobody speak Chinese," she said. "I interview for receptionist. They tell me my English not good enough. Nowhere I can find work. Nobody to watch the baby." She'd probably had postpartum depression at the very least, Mia realized. Perhaps even a postpartum psychotic break. The baby wouldn't nurse, and her milk had dried up. She had lost her job, a minimum wage post packing styrofoam cups into cartons when she'd gone into the hospital to have the baby, and had no money for formula. At last, and this was the part that Mia felt could not be a coincidence, she had, in desperation, gone to a fire station and left her baby on the doorstep. 2 policemen had found Bibi several days later lying under a park bench, unconscious from dehydration and hunger. They'd brought her to a shelter where she'd been showered, fed, prescribed antidepressants, and released 3 weeks later. But by then no one could tell her what had happened to her baby. A fire station, she had insisted. She'd left the baby at a fire station. No, she couldn't remember which. She had walked with the baby in her arms, round and round the city, trying to figure out what to do, and at last she'd passed a station, the windows glowing warm against the dark night, and she'd made up her mind. How many fire stations could there be? But no one would help her. "When you left her, you terminated your rights," the police told her. "Sorry, we can't give you any more information." Bibi, Mia knew, was desperate to find her daughter again. Had been searching for her for many months now, ever since she'd gotten herself back together. She had a job now, a steady, if low-paying one. She'd found a new apartment. Her mood had stabilized. But she hadn't been able to find out where her baby had gone. It was as if her child had simply disappeared. "Sometimes," she told Mia, "I wonder if I am dreaming. But which one is the dream?" She dabbed her eyes with the back of her cuff. "That I can't find my baby? Or that I have the baby at all?" In all her years of itinerant living, Mia had developed one rule. Don't get attached to any place, to any apartment, to anything, to anyone. Since Pearl had been born, they'd lived, by Mia's count, in 46 different towns, keeping their possessions to what would fit in a Volkswagen, in other words, to a bare minimum. They seldom stayed long enough to make friends anywhere, and in the few cases where they had, they'd moved on with no forwarding address and lost contact. At each move, they discarded everything they could leave behind, and sent off Mia's art to Anita to be sold, which meant they'd never see it again. So Mia had always avoided getting involved in the affairs of others. It made everything simpler. It made it easier when their lease was up, or she'd grown tired of the town, or she'd felt, uneasily, that she wanted to be elsewhere. But this, with Bibi, this was different. The idea that someone might take a mother's child away, it horrified her. It was as if someone had slid a blade into her, and with one quick twist, hollowed her out, leaving nothing inside but a cold rush of air.
At that moment, Pearl came into the kitchen in search of a drink, and Mia wrapped her arms around her daughter quickly, as if she were on the edge of a precipice, and held her so long and so tightly that Pearl finally said, "Mom, are you okay?" These McCulloughs, Mia was sure, were good people. But that wasn't the point. She thought suddenly of those moments at the restaurant, after the dinner rush had ended and things were quiet, when Bibi sometimes rested her elbows on the counter and drifted away. Mia understood exactly where she drifted to. To a parent, your child wasn't just a person. Your child was a place, a kind of Narnia, a vast, eternal place where the present you were living and the past you remembered and the future you longed for all existed at once. You could see it every time you looked at her. Layered in her face was the baby she'd been and the child she'd become and the adult she would grow up to be. And you saw them all simultaneously, like a 3D image. It made your head spin. It was a place you could take refuge, if you knew how to get in. And each time you left it, each time your child passed out of your sight, you feared you might never be able to return to that place again. Early on, the very first night she and Pearl had begun their travels, Mia had curled up on their makeshift bed in the back seat of the Rabbit, with baby Pearl snuggled in the curve of her belly, and watched her daughter sleep. There, so close that she could feel Pearl's warm, milky breath on her cheek, she had marveled at this little creature. "Bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh," she had thought. Her mother had made her go to Sunday school every week until she was 13, and as if the words were a spell, she suddenly saw hints of her mother's face in Pearl's. The set of the jaw, the faint wrinkle between the eyebrows that appeared as Pearl drifted into a puzzling dream. She had not thought about her mother in some time, and a sharp bolt of longing flashed through her chest. As if it had disturbed her, Pearl yawned and stretched, and Mia had cuddled her closer, stroked her hair, pressed her lips to that unbelievably soft cheek. "Bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh," she had thought again, as Pearl's eyes fluttered closed once more, and she was certain that no one could ever love this child as she did. "I'm fine," she said to Pearl now, and with a wrenching effort, she let her daughter go. "All finished here. Let's go home, okay?" Even then, Mia had a sense of what she was starting. A hot smell pricked her nostrils, like the first wisp of smoke from a far-off blaze. She did not know if Bibi would get her baby back. All she knew was that the thought of someone else claiming her child was unbearable. How could these people, she thought, how could these people take a child from its mother? She told herself this all night and into the next morning, as she dialed, as she waited for the phone to ring. It wasn't right. A mother should never have to give up her child. "Bibi," she said, when a voice picked up on the other end. "It's Mia, from work. There's something I think you should know." 10. This was why, while Pearl and Mia were eating dinner Tuesday evening, the doorbell rang, followed by a frantic knocking. Mia ran down to the side door, and Pearl heard a murmur of voices and crying, and then her mother came into the kitchen, followed by a young Chinese woman who was sobbing. "I knock and knock," Bibi was saying. "I ring the doorbell, and they don't answer, so I knock and knock. I can see that woman inside, peeking out from behind the curtain to check if I go away." Mia guided her to a chair, her own, with a plate of half-finished noodles still in front of it. "Pearl, get Bibi some water, and maybe make some tea." She sat down in the other chair and leaned across the table to take Bibi's hand. "You shouldn't have just gone over there like that. You couldn't expect them to just let you come right in."
"I call her first."
Bibi wiped her face on the back of her hand, and Mia took a napkin from the table and nudged it toward her. It was actually an old flowered handkerchief from the thrift store, and Baby scrubbed at her eyes.
I look them up in the phone book and call them right after I hang up with you. Nobody answer. I just get the machine. What kind of message I am going to leave? So I try them again and again all morning until finally somebody answer at 2 o'clock. She answer.
Across the kitchen, Pearl set the kettle on the stove and clicked on the burner. She had never met Bibi before, though her mother had mentioned her once or twice. Her mother hadn't said how pretty Bibi was. Big eyes, high cheekbones, thick black hair swept up into a ponytail. Or how young. To Pearl, anyone over about 20 seemed impossibly adult, but she guessed that Bibi might be 25 or so. Definitely younger than her mother, but there was something almost childish in the way she spoke. In the way she sat, with her feet primly together and her hands clasped. In the way she glanced up at Mia helplessly, as if she were Mia's daughter too, that made her think of Bibi as if she were another teenager. Pearl did not realize, nor would she for a while yet, how unusually self-possessed her mother was for someone her age. How savvy and seasoned.
I tell her who I am, Bibi was saying. I say, this is Linda McCullough, and she say yes, and I tell her, my name is Bibi Chow. I am Mei Ling's mother. Just like that, she hang up on me.
Mia shook her head.
I call her back, and she pick up the phone and hang it up again. And then I call her again, and I get just a busy signal.
Bibi wiped her nose with a napkin and crumpled it into a ball.
So I go over there. 2 buses, and I have to ask the driver where to change, and then I walk another mile to their house. Those huge houses. Everybody over there drive. No one wants to take a bus to work. I ring the front doorbell, and nobody answer. But she watching from upstairs, just looking down at me. I ring the bell again and again, and I calling, Mrs. McCullough, it's me, Bibi. I just want to talk to you. And then the curtain close. But she's still in there, just waiting for me to go away, like I am going to go away when my baby is in there. So I keep on knocking and ringing. Sooner or later she has to come out, and then I can talk to her.
She glanced at Mia.
I just want to see my baby again. I think I can talk with these McCulloughs and get them to understand. But she will not come out.
Bibi fell silent for a long time and looked down at her hands. And Pearl saw the skin reddened and raw along the sides of her fists. She must have been banging on the door for a long, long time, she realized. And she thought simultaneously of how much pain Bibi must have been in, must still be in, and how terrified Mrs. McCullough, locked inside the house, must have felt. The rest of the story poured out haltingly, as if Bibi were only now piecing the scene together herself. Sometime later, Alexis had pulled up, with a police car right behind it, and Mr. McCullough had emerged. He had told Bibi to leave the property, 2 police officers flanking him like bodyguards. Bibi had tried to tell them she only wanted to see her baby, but wasn't sure now what she had said, if she had argued or threatened or raged or begged. All she could remember was the line Mr. McCullough kept repeating.
You have no right to be here. You have no right to be here.
And finally, one of the officers took her by the arm and pulled her away.
Go, they had said, or they would take her down to the station and charge her with trespassing.
This she recalled clearly, as the policeman pulled her away from the house. She could hear her child crying from behind the locked front door.
Oh, Bibi, Mia said,
and Pearl could not tell if she was disappointed or proud.
What else I can do? I walk all the way here, 45 minutes,
Who else I can ask for help but you?
She glared at Pearl and Mia fiercely, as if she thought they might contradict her.
I am her mother.
They know that, Mia said. They know that very well, or they wouldn't have run you off like that. She nudged the mug of tea, lukewarm now, toward Bibi.
What I can do now? If I go over there again, they call the police and arrest me.
You could get a lawyer, Pearl suggested, and Bibi gave her a gentle, pitying glance.
Where I am going to get money for a lawyer? She asked.
She glanced down at her clothing, black pants and a thin white button-down, and Pearl understood suddenly. This was her work uniform. She'd left work without even bothering to change.
In the bank, I have $611. You think a lawyer helped me for $611?
Okay, said Mia. She pushed the remains of Pearl's dinner, glazed now, with a white sheen of fat to one side. All this time she had been thinking. In fact, she'd been thinking about this ever since Lexi had mentioned the baby. About what she would do if she were in Bibi's position. About what it was possible for anyone in Bibi's position to do. Listen to me. Do you want to fight this fight? Here's what you do. Wednesday afternoon. Had any of the Richardson children been paying attention to the commercials during Jerry Springer, they might have noticed the teasers for the Channel 3 evening news, with a photo of the McCulloughs' house. If they had, they might have notified their mother, who was hammering out a story on a proposed school levy and would not be home to watch the news, or to alert Mrs. McCullough. But as it happened, Lexi and Tripp were so involved in a spirited argument over which guest had better hair, the drag queen or his embittered ex-wife, that no one heard the commercials. Pearl and Moody, looking on in bemusement, didn't even glance at the screen, and Lexi had interrupted before Tripp was halfway through his case for the drag queen. Izzy, meanwhile, was at Mia's in the darkroom, watching her pull a new print from the developer and hang it to dry. So no one saw the teasers for the nightly news, or watched the news that evening. Mrs. McCullough was also not a news watcher, and thus, when she answered her doorbell early Thursday morning with Mirabelle on her hip, expecting a parcel from her sister, she was alarmed to find Barbara Pierce, Channel 9's bouffanted local investigative journalist, standing on her front steps with a microphone in hand.
"Mrs. McCullough!"
Barbara cried, as if they'd run into each other at a party and it was all a delightful coincidence. Behind her loomed a burly cameraman in a parka, though all Mrs. McCullough registered was the barrel of a lens and a blinking red light like one glowing eye. Mirabelle began to cry.
"We understand that you're in the process of adopting a little girl. Are you aware her mother is fighting to regain custody?"
Mrs. McCullough slammed the door shut, but the news crew had gotten what they'd come for. Only 2.5 seconds of footage, but it was enough. The slender white woman at the door of her imposing brick shaker house, looking angry and afraid, clutching the screaming Asian baby in her arms. With a vague sense of foreboding, Mrs. McCullough checked the clock. Her husband was en route to work downtown and would not be there for another 35 minutes at least. She called one friend after another, but none of them had seen the news story the night before either, and they could offer only moral support, not enlightenment.
"Don't worry," each said in turn. "It'll be okay. Just Barbara Pierce stirring up trouble."
Mr. McCullough, meanwhile, arrived at work and took the elevator up to the 7th floor, where Rayburn Financial Services had their offices. He had just extricated one arm from his overcoat when Ted Rayburn appeared in his doorway.
"Listen, Mark," he said. "I don't know if you saw the news last night on Channel 3, but there's something you should know about."
He shut the door behind him, and Mr. McCullough listened, still clutching his overcoat against himself as if it were a towel. Ted Rayburn, in the same measured, slightly concerned tones he used with clients, described the news segment. The outside shot of the McCullough's house, shaded in the evening light, but still familiar to him from their years of hosting cocktail parties, brunches, summer barbecues. The anchor's lead-in. Adoptions are about giving new homes to children who don't have families. But what if the child already has a family? And the interview with the mother, B-something, Ted hadn't caught the full name, who had begged for her baby on camera. "I make a mistake," she said, every syllable carefully enunciated. "Now I have a good job. I have my life together now. I want my baby back. These McCulloughs have no right to adopt a baby when her own mother wants her. A child belongs with her mother." Ted Rayburn had nearly finished when the phone on the desk rang, and Mr. McCullough, seeing the number, knew that it was his wife and what was happening and what he would now have to explain to her. He picked up the receiver. "I'm coming home," he said, and set it down again and picked up his keys. Mia, who did not own a television, had not seen the news segment either. But Wednesday afternoon, just before it aired, Bibi dropped by to tell her how the interview had gone. "They think this is a good story," she said. She was wearing her black pants and a white shirt with a faded soy sauce stain on the cuff, and from this Mia knew she was headed into work. "They talked to me for almost an hour. They have very many questions for me." She broke off at the sound of footsteps on the stairs. It was Izzy, just arrived from school, and both of them fell silent at the sight of a stranger. "I better go," Bibi said after a moment. "The bus coming soon." On the way out the door, she leaned close to Mia. "They say people really going to get behind me," she whispered. "Who was that?" Izzy asked when Bibi had gone. "Just a friend," Mia had answered. "A friend from work." The producers at Channel 3, as it turned out, had good instincts. In the hours after the segment aired, the station had been flooded with calls about the story, enough to warrant a follow-up, and enough for Channel 9, ever competitive, to deploy Barbara Pierce first thing the next morning. "Barbara Pierce," Linda McCullough said to Mrs. Richardson Thursday evening. "Barbara Pierce, with her stilettos and her Dolly Parton hair, showed up on my doorstep and shoved a microphone in my face." The two women had just watched Barbara Pierce's segment, each on her own couch, in front of the television, holding the cordless phone to her ear. And Mrs. Richardson had the sudden, eerie feeling that they were 14 again, princess phones in their laps, watching Green Acres in tandem so that they could hear each other laugh. "That's what Barbara Pierce does," Mrs. Richardson said. "Miss Sensational Action News in a skirt suit. She's a bully with a cameraman." "The lawyer says we're on solid footing," Mrs. McCullough said. "He says that by leaving the baby, she gave up custody to the state, and the state gave it to us, so her grievance is really with the state and not us. He says the process is 80% complete, and it'll only take another month or two for Mirabelle to be ours permanently, and then this woman will have no claim on her at all." They had tried so long, she and her husband, for a baby. After their wedding, she'd gotten pregnant right away. And then a few weeks later, she'd begun bleeding, and she knew even before they consulted the doctor that the baby was gone. "Very common," the doctor had reassured her. "Half of all pregnancies end in the first few weeks. Most women don't even know they conceived." But Mrs. McCullough had known. And 3 months later, when it happened again, and again 4 months after that, and again 5 months after that, she had been painfully aware, each time, that something alive had sparked in her, and that somehow that little spark had gone out. The doctors prescribed patience, vitamins, iron supplements. Another pregnancy came. This time it was nearly 10 weeks before the bleeding began. Mrs. McCullough cried at night, and after she fell asleep, her husband cried beside her. After 3 years of trying, she had been pregnant 5 times, and there was still no baby. "Wait 6 months," the obstetrician recommended. "Let your body recover." When the waiting period was up, they tried again. 2 months later, she was pregnant. A month later, she was not. Each time she told no one, hoping that if she sealed the knowledge tight inside her, it would stay and grow. Nothing changed. By then, her old friend Elena had a girl and a boy and was pregnant with a third. And though Elena called often, though she would happily have taken Linda into her arms and let her cry, as they'd done so often for each other growing up, over big things and small, Mrs. McCullough found this was something she could not share. She never told Elena when she was pregnant, so how could she tell her the pregnancy had ended? She did not even know how to begin. I lost another one. It happened again. Whenever they had lunch, Mrs. McCullough could not keep herself from staring at Mrs. Richardson's rounding belly. She felt like a pervert. She so badly wanted to touch it, to stroke it, to caress it. In the background, Lexi and Tripp babbled and tottered, and it became easier after a while to simply avoid it all. Mrs. Richardson, for her part, noticed that her dear friend Linda called her less, that when she herself called, she often got the machine. Mrs. McCullough's cheery voice singing, "Leave a message for Linda or Mark, and we'll call you back." But no one ever did. The year after Izzy was born, Mrs. McCullough became pregnant again. By then it was exhausting. The plotting of her cycle, the waiting, the calls to the doctor. Even the sex, carefully scheduled for her most fertile days, had begun to feel like a chore. Who'd ever have believed it, she thought, remembering high school when she and Mark had fumbled frantically against each other in the back seat of his car. The doctors put her on strict bed rest. No more than 40 minutes a day on her feet, including trips to the bathroom. No exertions. She made it to almost 5 months before she woke at 2 a.m. with a terrible stillness in her belly, like the silence after a bell has stopped ringing. At the hospital, while she lay in a drugged fog, the doctors coaxed the baby from her womb. "Do you want to see her?" one asked when it was over. And a nurse held out the baby, swaddled in a white cloth, in her cupped palms. To Mrs. McCullough, she looked impossibly tiny, impossibly rose-colored, impossibly glossy and smooth, like something blown from pink glass, impossibly still. She nodded vaguely, shut her eyes again, spread her legs to let the doctor stitch her up. She began to walk the long way around to the store to avoid the playground, the elementary school, the bus stop. She began to hate pregnant women. She wanted to slap them, to throw things at them, to grab them by the shoulders and bite them. On their 10th wedding anniversary, Mr. McCullough took her to Giovanni's, her favorite restaurant, and as they entered, a vastly pregnant woman waddled up behind them. Mrs. McCullough pushed the door open and then, as the pregnant woman came up behind, let it shut in the woman's face. And Mr. McCullough, turning back to take his wife's arm, for a moment could not recognize this woman. So callous, so different from the endlessly maternal woman he'd always known. Finally, after one last doctor's appointment full of heart-rending phrases, low motility sperm, inhospitable womb, conception likely impossible, they decided to adopt. Even IVF would likely fail, the doctors had advised them. Adoption was their best chance.